Zorn, 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 the greatest father in all the land. Zorn, 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 we sing the praises of Zorn.
Eric Zorn is here. It's Bill Left back from vacation and Wendy Snyder here on 720 WGN. And Bill, you were kind of unplugged when you were on vacation.
100%. I didn't watch the news. I didn't read newspapers. No internet. I loved it. It was fun to do.
What did he miss, Eric?
I can't do that when I go on vacation. I mean, it makes me, nervous. Makes me anxious. I want to find out what's going on.
There was a part of me that said there could be some big things that are going on that I'm just not privy to. And that made me a little nervous. But every once in a while, to just go 4 or 5 days without everything like that, it feels so good.
You missed a big, huge helping of liberal tears.
What happened there?
Well, I mean, the big news of the week, obviously, is Anthony Kennedy, the so-called swing justice on the Supreme Court, has stepped down.
I knew that.
You know, Donald Trump gets to shape the Supreme Court for the next generation, at least.
So we can expect it to be a much more right-leaning Supreme Court, right?
Slightly more, and things like Roe versus Wade is probably in danger. And it was decided in 1972, I think. But the fear
there is that it could be somehow overturned.
The fear of those who think that it's settled law. I mean, even like Susan Collins of Maine, the Republican senator, was saying yesterday she didn't think it was going to be overturned, and she thought she was looking to vote for a justice that would confirm it. But I think that it's probably gone. That what's going to happen is there are going to be state laws. They're going to start slowly restricting the time that women can obtain an abortion, and then also the places and manner that they can get an abortion. Until finally the right as such is just basically eroded to nothing, and then it'll just be a little shove, and the right will be gone. And in a lot of states, probably not Illinois, at least not right away. So, but it's going to. But you know what's going to happen with this? And there was another big ruling in the Supreme Court last week about labor law. And both of them were very produced a lot of anxiety on the part of liberals, left-leaning people. And I think what can happen in situations like this is that the other side will rise up, can really get energized by something like this.
Right.
And you saw it with the Tea Party movement on the right back in 2009 and 2010 when the fears about Obamacare and about government overspending. Republicans have put those concerns on hold now that Trump is vastly overspending. But the Tea Party movement arose out of a great deal of anger on the right that they were getting steamrolled by Democrats. And I think that you may see some of that coming from the left now, that there's a lot of concern, a lot of mobilization about issues like workers' rights and women's reproductive rights and so on. So you may see a kind of energy that the sleeping giant may be awakened. Because when you look at polls, you take public opinion polls on Roe versus Wade, you find something like about 2/3 of the public does not want it overturned.
Yeah.
So, it's always in the 60s when they poll on it, and Gallup polls on it all the time, and Pew in those places. So you have this rather substantial majority of the public that feels like, let's leave Roe alone. I mean, most people, when you look at the issue of abortion, most people are uneasy with it. It's not something people are like, yeah, I'm all for abortion. It's like, you're there for abortion rights.
Right.
But the process itself makes people uneasy.
Sure.
So they want some limits on it. They don't want women who are 8 months pregnant going, oh, I can't fit into my prom dress. Let me get an abortion. On the other hand, they don't want people who are raped, say, or
have a dangerous delivery.
They basically the people who say like they want it to be, as Bill Clinton used to say, safe, legal, and rare.
Yeah.
And it's a subject that brings up a lot of conflicting feelings on people, and so most people are kind of in the middle, and it's a hard position to stake out in the middle. Like, well, I think up to a certain point, a woman should be able to allow to choose, and then after that point, it's more and more the business of the government, the state, to say yes or no.
All right,
but that's where we are right now with Roe. So
if this becomes a state by state decision, are the lines drawn as simple as the red states and the blue states? Is it going to be pretty much that way?
Well, it looks that way now. Yeah. Certainly, some of the legal analysts have said that Roe will be gone essentially in 20 states in 2 years.
Yeah.
With this new justice that presumably will vote to overturn it. Now, other people are saying that maybe someone like Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, I should say. Who has some affinity toward precedent, who thinks that, we've decided this is settled law, it's been more than 40 years, maybe we should not overturn this, so that maybe they would trim their sails some But it would probably be, yeah, you'd see states like Iowa, for instance. You'd see states like Oklahoma, Kansas. A lot of the red states would enact very severe abortion restrictions. And states like Michigan, Illinois, New York, California would not. So in a sense, what would happen would be that wealthier women, women of means, women who have the ability to travel, abortion would still be legal for them. As it was long ago when abortion was illegal everywhere and women would travel to Puerto Rico and places like
that. Aren't there a couple states where there's only one or two licensed places where you could get an abortion?
Yeah, now there are. Yeah. And they've managed, that's in the South, there are places where basically there's one or two clinics that are still allowed to be open, and those are under constant pressure from picketers.
Yeah, right.
And the doctors who perform the abortions there feel that their lives are in danger and so on. So it's the right itself, the right of access to abortion is dwindling. And I think women are getting more and more concerned about that, and you may see this political backlash. And I think you may also see this, and I wanted to touch on this decision that was made about union rights. Essentially, what the decision was in the Janus case. Mark Janus is a state of Illinois worker, and he sued because he didn't want to have to pay what are called agency fees to the union. And he didn't belong to the union. He's a state worker. He worked with Ask Me workers. And there's a 40-year-old ruling that said, well, you don't have to pay your full union dues because some of those dues go to political activity that you might not agree with. But you do have to pay a certain percent of your union fees, even if you don't want to belong to the union, because you benefit from the union's collective bargaining agreements.
Yep.
You get the pension, you get the medical care, you get the salary increases.
You get benefits.
So you get benefits, so you have to pay for those benefits. That's been law for 40 years, a Supreme Court decision in, I think, 77. And the Supreme Court last week said, well, no, because if you're a public sector union, anything that the union does is inherently political because it involves the spending of public money that you can opt out of paying anything. You can just say, I'm not going to pay anything. You can still get all the benefits of being in the union. You can get all the raises, the pension, the health care, all that stuff, but you don't have to pay anything for the collective bargaining. You also get represented in grievances, even if you're not paying any money.
That's not fair for the people who pay.
Well, that would be how I see it, but that's not how the Supreme Court saw it. And so this has been seen by not just state workers, but also other organized workers and other just sort of ordinary people as a real blow to an already faltering labor market.
Yeah. Right?
You've got the percentage of unionized workers is somewhere around like 10% now in this country. And most of those are public sector unions. I mean, the union movement is really in trouble. It's really under assault. And the union movement does prop up in many ways the middle class. And it does, you know, I think a lot of people feel like, you know, fairness to workers, and these are people. These are not just paper pushers and so on. These are nurses. They're home health care people. They are police officers. They're firefighters. People like that who are organized, whose unions are going to suffer.
Right.
So you may see, and Rick Pearson had an excellent WGN's own Rick Pearson had a really good excellent story in yesterday's Tribune talking about how this decision, and Bruce Rauner had championed this decision. He was really all in favor. He's a big cheerleader for Janus, the guy who won the case, he was down in Washington, like waiting several days for the opinion to come out, so he could do his little end zone dance on the steps of the Supreme Court. Even though I argue that he really didn't have a whole lot to do with this case, except for as a cheerleader, that Rauner may end up paying a political price for this. That he was elected back in 2014 with union support.
Right.
He got a lot of people who voted for him because they were angry at Pat Quinn, because Quinn had not been fully on board with the state workers' unions. You can look back on that and say that was a really regrettable decision by those people in labor who thought that they were going to have a better friend in Bruce Rauner. I don't know why they thought that, but they were really angry at Pat Quinn.
There was a time where if you were running for political office, your first move was to get in good with the unions. You wanted to impress the unions and let them know that you were on their side. Right. Is that no longer the case?
Well, it's going to be less and less the case, I think, because one of the things, the effect of this ruling, this Janus ruling, as predicted by the people who really know this stuff, who study it, say that you're probably going to see 8 to 10% drop off in union membership, meaning an 8%, 10% drop in union funding. And the unions do spend a lot of money and do a lot of organizing that is political. And most of their organizing is in favor of the Democratic Party.
Right.
And so a lot of people saw this as just a partisan move on Bruce Rauner's part. And he was talking about it. Well, this is the First Amendment. And this is how the ruling was presented, which was like, this is you're abridging Mark Janus's right not to speak up in favor of the union. You're making him support the union. So it's his freedom of speech has been abridged. But actually, you know, Bruce Rauner has historically been hostile toward public sector unions. Totally thinks they're a really bad thing. And you look at what happens then when the public sector unions then lose their power, then that affects the Democratic Party for the most part. And it also bleeds over into the power of the private sector unions, too. And no one thinks that Bruce Rauner is a friend of private sector unions.
Yeah, so. Yeah. All right, let's do this. We'll take a break, and then you have some tweets of the month.
I have the top tweets of June. They're great.
Excellent.
Another month went by?
Another month,
wow-y,
Wendy.
Wow.
It happens fast. All right, that's coming up next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Jasmine, I don't know what I have to read, quite honestly. I have this to read.
Read the lyrics to this song.
I have this to read. It's Bill Leff back from vacation and Wendy Snyder, and we're visiting with Chicago Tribune's Eric Zorn.
Eric, there. Every month you share the top tweets of the month with us.
I do. I collect the top tweets of the week, and then I have readers vote on them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then at the end of the month, I look back at all the entries. They're usually about
thousands.
40 or 50. Well, not thousands. I look through thousands, for sure. These are the best of the thousands. And I look through the ones that were nominated, and I pick the 10 best.
Can you one day bring in the 10 worst of the month?
I could do that. Maybe I'll do that next month. Because, right. You know, July could be a slow month. Maybe
it could be.
It reminds me, there was a great... I'll just read these.
All right.
Here we go.
Here it goes.
Top 10 tweets of June 2018. The first one is a little dialogue. Me. May I please have a gin and tonic with a twist? Bartender. Here you go, gin and tonic. Oh, and you've been dead this whole time.
That's silly.
Now, I just want to remind you that these will be posted to the Bill and Wendy
Facebook. Did M. Night Shyamalan write that one?
That's a good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. He sees dead people.
Yeah.
These will be posted. I'm not going to attribute them because that breaks up my rhythm of my routine here. But they'll be posted on the Bill and Wendy Facebook page with all the links
be.
And the attributions the way it ought to be.
Yeah.
Seriously, how ugly was Little Red Riding Hood's grandma? Life is a constant balancing act between wondering why you weren't invited to something and wondering how to get out of it.
Oh, that's great. Good. Good.
How does Time Warner not make alarm clocks?
because of the name Time Warner.
Time Warner, right. To maintain a close family bond, I like to send my children a good morning text every day as we gather around the breakfast table. Will.i.am's headstone will read, Will I Was.
That's funny. Yeah.
Completing history's longest setup to a punchline.
I like that.
It's a good thing the torch on the Statue of Liberty isn't real, otherwise she would have set herself on fire months ago. Welcome to Overthinking Club. Or is it Overthinkers Club?
Good.
That's perfect, and I should be in there.
Mm-hmm.
Ironing boards are just surfboards that gave up their dreams and got real jobs. And the last one, when my wife told me to stop pretending to be a flamingo, I just had to put my foot down.
Very good. What a month this was for funny tweets.
It was a good month.
Sometimes there are just a couple that are...
Yeah.
But this
They're
month,
pretty good.
This month was fabulous.
Do you want to talk about the open borders lie a little bit?
I do want to talk about that. That's a column that I wrote for Sunday, and it has to do with the constant refrain that the president has been speaking and tweeting that the Democrats are in favor of open borders.
Mm-hmm.
He says Democrats want open borders, which will lead to more crime. Now, when you think of open borders, you think of the border between, you know, Michigan and Indiana or Illinois and Wisconsin.
Right.
You drive, welcome to
right.
Wisconsin.
Very friendly.
Very friendly. Or you think of the old checkpoints between the U.S. and Canada. Did you ever travel
sure.
to camp, like back in the 70s and 80s?
Yep.
And you just like driving. They go, where are you going? You go,
yeah.
just going up there. Well, fine. You know.
What do you have to declare?
Have a good day. Sometimes not. I mean, it's just very, you just kind of go over. They didn't care.
Right.
But no, there's, as far as I can tell, there are very few people who are actually in favor of open borders. The open borders has become sort of this code word, this inflammatory code word for a more relaxed immigration policy. And so you when you have the president accusing the Democrats of being in favor of open borders, there have been a number of journalistic organizations that have fact-checked this, that have gone and looked at what Democrats have actually voted for, what they've supported, what their candidates have said.
Yeah.
And it just relentlessly and repetitively, all the fact-check organizations say, no, this is false. There are very few Democrats who are in favor of open borders. The only one I could find was a maybe was Keith Ellison, who is the he's a congressman up in Minnesota. He's running for attorney general in Minnesota. He's a Muslim, and he's, I think, deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee. He was photographed at a parade wearing a shirt in Spanish that said something like, you know, I don't believe in borders.
Oh.
And I saw this reported, and I tried to reach out to him and find out what exactly he meant by that.
Any luck?
Well, no, there was no, I didn't have any luck. I reached his people, and his people said, we'll get back to you, and they didn't. This happens to me sometimes. It enrages me. So what happened was that, you know, you have this thing is promoted, open borders, and it begins to take effect. And the truth is that Democrats have voted over and over again for tighter border security.
Yeah.
They've voted for money and for increased technology on the border. And when you look at like President Obama's record, he deported a lot of people, more than President Bush did. I mean, he was people were very critical of President Obama for deporting too many people.
Yeah.
So it's not like the Democrats have not supported border security, don't believe in closed borders, don't believe in documentation. It's just a question of your philosophy as to what you do with the people who are already here, who have been here for years, who have children who were born here. If you've got these kids, the so-called dreamers who brought here as children, what do you do about those people? There's also the question of whether you want to have, you know, quote-unquote sanctuary cities or sanctuary states where the local police don't participate with the federal government in helping them arrest undocumented immigrants and so on. So there's all kinds of questions and debates, and there are good debates to be had about what do we do about, you know, strengthening the border. And there's no question that Democrats, you know, every mainstream Democrat I could find, with a possible exception of Keith Ellison,
mm-hmm.
Believe that we need to have borders. We need people who come in. We need to know who they are. This is ideal. The question is, where do you want to put your resources? Do you want to build, you know, spend billions of dollars to build walls, or do you want to have other kinds of security? And then what do you do with the people who are here? When you have someone who's been here for 20 years and has been working and has been paying taxes and whose children were born here, do you want to create a path to citizenship? I mean, this is, we're touching
on this. If they've been paying taxes and everything, how have they hurt us?
Well, they haven't, and that's the other thing is that, I mean, this gets to a larger issue with immigration, which is that most people believe that immigration is a very strong boost to our economy, that you have people coming here and they're working, they're paying taxes, they're contributing to the GDP, they're contributing to the bottom line. They don't take out more in benefits than they pay in taxes and their
just want to escape where they came from.
Well, some of them come here for a better life, no question about it.
But you're talking about the ones who are in fact paying taxes. One of the arguments is that there's so many that are not paying taxes.
Well, there are certainly some who aren't,
right.
And there's certainly some who are criminals. And I don't think there's much of a debate that you want to get people who are actually like, you know, felons and, you know, gang members and so on to get them out of the country. The thing is that you can really, when you're talking about this issue, you can really caricature the other position on the other side. And what's happening here is, with the president repeating this over and over again, Democrats are for open borders, Democrats, that this is not helping us have any kind of rational conversation about
right.
this issue, you know, to talk about, okay, what do you do with a child who was brought here totally against his or her will when they're 3, 5 and they're college age? Do you send them back to the country that they don't know anymore? You've got someone who's been living here for 20 years, who's maybe bought a house, who's got relatives here, who's got a whole situation. Do you just send them back to this country, or do you figure out a way to naturalize them the way President Reagan did back in the 80s? I mean, there's a way of saying, well, these people are here, they're contributing to our society, they're contributing to
right.
our economy. And so that's the debate we need to be having. I'm not trying to solve that debate right here, but I'm saying that when you throw terms like open borders around, you just poison the debate.
Sure.
You set everybody's teeth on it.
Yeah. So this isn't fair to ask you, because there's 25 seconds, and I know you can't answer it in 25 seconds.
Oh, just give me a try.
Why has this administration made immigration the number one problem in America, when realistically, it might not even be cracking the top 10?
It isn't. You're right. And the reason is because it really excites a lot of passions. It is really about our identity as a country. It is about people whose fears that we're changing the nature of America.
Yeah.
And I understand that. I really do understand people's fears of, like, what is our country if people aren't melting in the melting pot anymore, if it's like more of a stew, is it, what is the country about? And so it plays on fears, and that's why when Trump wanted to sell his tax cuts, but his tax cuts really aren't going over that well, that they're not that popular. But fear works, and people are afraid of what's happening to their culture, and they're also afraid individually of this MS-13 gang and people and the crime. So that's why you hear crime and immigration thrown in together, because fear is a great motivator.
Yeah, I guess.
That's it.
I guess. That's Eric Zorn. A quick break, and then we'll find out what Steve has on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks, Eric. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.